Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Leah Stein. Her dance company is presenting Gate, a site-specific performance project at Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site in Philadelphia. Jason Pfeiffer spends time with the Keystone State Boy Choir and the Pennsylvania Girl Choir as they prepare for the third annual Commonwealth Youth Choirs Gala at the Kimmel Center. We speak with Andrew Kurtz, Artistic Director of Center City Opera Theater. The company opened its production of Lowell Lieberman's The Picture of Dorian Gray this week. And Susan Lewis visits Winterthur, the Wilmington, Delaware Museum and Country Estate. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
A new dance production debuted in Philadelphia this week, but instead of taking place on a stage in front of an audience, the performance was in an abandoned prison that had served as the inspiration for its creation. Leah Stein created Gate, a site-specific work for Eastern State Penitentiary. It's now being performed in several areas of the 11-acre historic site, with the audience accompanying dancers and musicians through abandoned prison cell blocks, corridors and courtyards. Film is projected onto the textured surfaces of the building and dancers appear, disappear and reappear as the work progresses. Gate is the third in a series called On-Site Philadelphia, a citywide dance project from the Leah Stein Dance Company that incorporates unusual and historic sites and local communities. Previous productions were at Bartram's Garden and Christ Church. I met with Leah Stein earlier this week during a break in rehearsals for Gate in the courtyard between cell blocks 3 and 4 at Eastern State Penitentiary. What are the attractions of creating work in a situation like this?
Well, in general, just working on site really interests me. I'm very interested in what happens that's different on site than in the theater. There's no ceiling, the natural light, the complexity of the architecture, the interrelationship between nature and architecture. All of that really stimulates my creative process anyway and always has my dances. And I find it like another element to choreograph. It's like a partner. And it really helps define the choreographic structure. I just feel very, like I get, my creative juices get going. And especially, I think the elements of choreography are time and space, working with in the human body, time and space. And I love the way a site creates even more of a dynamic interaction with movement and sound and place.
And something of a dynamic interaction between performer and audience as well, in that a space like this was not obviously created for the performance of dance.
Right, yes, of course. That's also a big integral piece.
How do you accommodate that? Because in a situation now where you're rehearsing, there are actually very few people who are not a part of the production near you.
I imagine what they'll be doing, and you can't predict the audience, but I try to get a sense of what they'll be experiencing and seeing and how they'll move through the piece, and I structure it so that it actually leads the people into the space and through the space in a particular way. The way it unfolds guides people so that they're moving, which of course interests me, that the audience is not sitting but they're participating, and then that changes their whole perception of even their experience of the performance.
And is the audience then an integral part of it?
Yeah. And I often like when sometimes the performers move through the audience to change their point of view, so they look from, they may be facing one direction, the performers actually pass through them and then they turn around to look at the other direction, and then for that moment they're actually almost part of the performance as people in the same space. So I like blurring that line.
How much has the building contributed to the actual structure of the piece? Because as we're seeing this evening, continually the dancers having to become aligned with certain walls or certain architectural features. How much are you allowing the building or the structure to dictate to you what the final production will look like?
Totally. And specifically this work here at Eastern State Penitentiary is enormously complex on many levels, not just physically and architecturally, but psychologically and it's historically. So there's a lot going on that's influencing the choreographic structures, choices, and the piece would not exist without the site, which is true for all the works. And then this work in particular, because the architecture is so powerful in and of itself, just the way that the cell blocks are set up, the spoken, the hub and spoke floor plan visually is striking. There's already so much striking here, the state of decay, the viewpoints, the multiple viewpoints you can see through. You can see so many different views at once. You see different layers of history coming together architecturally, and of course the feeling of the place, the heavy or the light, because the light comes through the skylights. It's so complex, and all of that is directly feeding my ideas, the dancers' responses.
I was just going to ask you that. I mean, how enthusiastic are you for the dancers to have an understanding of what took place here?
Well, I am. We've done some research. I've done more than they have, and they've had an opportunity to come and to take some tours. We've taken tours. We've looked at the intake cards with specific information about different people to inform them of some specificity of the history without the piece being a narrative and being a story particularly.
Because it would have been very easy to write a very morbid piece based on,
right,
on the previous use of this building.
Right, of course. I mean, it's intense. It's intense to be here. I think we all have different reactions, and I hope to incorporate them into the piece.
Leah Stein. The remaining performances of the Leah Stein Dance Company's Gate are at Eastern State Penitentiary today and tomorrow, and next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. All performances begin at 6:30.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The third annual Commonwealth Youth Choirs Gala takes place in Philadelphia on Monday. The concert will feature two groups, the Keystone State Boy Choir and their sister ensemble, the Pennsylvania Girl Choir. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer recently visited each of these ensembles as they rehearsed for this upcoming performance.
On the second floor of the First Presbyterian Church in Germantown, dozens of grade school, middle school, and high school-aged boys are crowded into a rehearsal room, gathered to sing, and, by all appearances, enjoying themselves. Keystone State Boy Choir co-founder and associate artistic director Stephen Fisher says this sort of atmosphere is the hallmark of the group, which was started in 2001.
We began this boy choir with a very specific philosophy. It was the philosophy of Leonard Bernstein, who said that music making should be fun all the time, especially in rehearsals, because most of what a choir does is rehearse. Performance time is a small percentage.
Fisher says the boy choir always strives for a high level of music making. After all, with a repertoire ranging from Bach to Broadway, they frequently perform with groups like the Opera Company of Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. But for Fisher, it's important that this pursuit of excellence doesn't drain the joy of singing and put undue pressure on kids with extremely busy lives. He says choir involvement should be an affirming experience, especially with boys, for whom there's often a stigma attached to singing.
Boys in our society are taught to not be expressive. And so by being in a boy choir, what they're able to do is be expressive, but also be men, because the boy choir environment is very fraternal.
Not unlike the benefits reaped from playing football or baseball, Fisher says choir can provide a place of belonging for boys, instill confidence, and teach life skills. For instance, 18-year-old Marcus Simmons from West Philadelphia explains one lesson he's learned about being a team player.
Being in choirs in general, you really have to learn how to sing as a group and gel as a unit. I think that that's what really is challenging, because everyone learns their part generally, but unless you all learn it together and, you know people's tendencies and things so you can all maintain a balance, you really are not going to be able to do all the things that you want.
Simmons, a high school senior, has been with the Keystone State Boy Choir since its inception 6 years ago. Next year, he'll go to the University of Maryland on a full scholarship for voice. Yet while stories of choir members going on to build careers in music are inspiring, most of the choir boys won't pursue music as a vocation, which is fine, according to Stephen Fisher. For him, the priority is providing a sense of community for the youth.
I think that's a really great gift that we give to them, and I truly believe that they'll end up being better sons and fathers, husbands and partners and human beings because they know how to connect.
All the
Keeping boys connected to a choral group has always been a challenge for choir directors, especially as voices change during adolescence. Stephen Fisher says Keystone State Boy Choir takes pride in allowing young men to continue singing with the group, even as their voices drop. This is not the case with all boy choirs.
The old way was kick them out the door. But research shows that if you kick them out the door, they may never come back to singing again. And it also shows that if you sing them properly through the voice change, and that's the key, you have to know what you're doing, they end up being much stronger, more accomplished, more musical tenors and basses.
One of the notable but really not surprising absences from boy choir rehearsals are girls. To create a sense of camaraderie and avoid all the distractions of the opposite sex, this separation is very intentional. But girls also have an outlet for choral singing in the Pennsylvania Girl Choir. Started in 2004 and considered a sister group to the boy choir, the Pennsylvania Girl Choir operates under the same nonprofit umbrella as their brother ensemble. Music director Mark Anderson says that one valuable aspect of involvement in the girl choir is exposure to a diverse repertoire, selections that he hopes will give the young women an understanding of the world at large.
We try to give them the best choral literature that we can, give them an opportunity to sing things that they wouldn't maybe otherwise decide to sing, and you know, turn them on to music from pre-Renaissance to the 21st century. So hopefully we're giving them something here that they wouldn't get by turning on the radio or perhaps singing in their school choir or someplace else.
Like the boy choir, Anderson sees part of the girl choir mission as being about laying a solid base that will endure for years to come.
So we're not just focused on a performance. We're not just focused on a tour. It's a lot broader than that, and I want to lay a foundation for these guys that is going to give them the ability to be really intelligent choral singers for the rest of their lives.
This sentiment is not lost on 17-year-old Blair Thornburg, who has been singing under the direction of Anderson since she was in second grade, originally in a church choir. Thornburg says youth choir involvement has helped make music an integral part of her life.
Yeah, I've been looking at colleges lately, and it's sort of like everywhere I go, I have to figure out, like, well, what's the music program like? Like, what can I study? Can I do theory? Can I do performance? Can I do history? And I think being in the choir has definitely influenced this, like, love of music that maybe I wasn't really sure that I had before, and now I just know that I can't not study it. I mean, it would just be like giving up a huge part of myself.
In cultivating a deep love and appreciation for music in girls, and boys for that matter, it doesn't hurt that they get opportunities to perform in venues all around the world. 2 years ago, the girl choir went on tour to Iceland, and last summer they spent time in the Pacific Northwest. And then there are performance opportunities at places like the Kimmel Center. Almost old hat for 15-year-old Mara Church.
I think it's really exciting. You know, you hear of people performing at the Kimmel Center that are so well known or that are such amazing musicians, and this will be my third year in performing in this venue, and it's just really cool because the audience is really big and the sound is beautiful.
During their gala event at the Kimmel, the boy choir and girl choir will perform separately and then come together for a joint grand finale featuring 130 voices. It will be their final performance of the season before both choirs set out on tour in just a few weeks. The girls are headed to Europe in late June, while the boys will tour Australia in early July.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Keystone State Boy Choir and Pennsylvania Girl Choir take part in the third annual Commonwealth Youth Choirs Gala at the Perelman Theatre at the Kimmel Centre for the Performing Arts on Monday at 7. Paris can and does, London does, as does New York. All of these great cities support more than one professional opera company. You can also count Philadelphia among this list of dual opera cities. Besides the Opera Company of Philadelphia, itself an amalgam of two companies, Center City Opera Theatre has in recent years become the very visible other opera company in the city. It began life in the suburbs in the late 90s, but since moving its performances to the Kimmel Center in 2003, has garnered a growing reputation for staging lesser performed and newer works. This week, the company presents its much-anticipated reworking of Lowell Lieberman's The Picture of Dorian Gray. Producing artistic director Andrew Kurtz came into our studio recently. I first asked him if there was sufficient demand for opera in Philadelphia to support two professional companies.
When you look at the performances in terms of overall numbers, with one professional company, you have four productions, and I certainly don't think four productions is a maximum number that are an option for a city of this size. Even with our additions, we're still not talking, I don't think, of critical mass when it comes to professional productions and the opportunities. Not to mention, we're very much a complement to the Opera Company of Philadelphia. They do grand opera. We do intimate opera. Our productions are in smaller spaces. They are, of course, professional, but it gives us a chance to explore different type of repertoire as well as doing things really focused in a much more theatrical vein as opposed to a grand opera vein.
You've been around for almost a decade at this point, but there's been a lot more attention on Center City Opera Theater in the last couple of years since you moved into the Perelman Theater at the Kimmel Center.
Definitely the move to the Kimmel Center changed things for the company. It also gave us a different ability to produce opera in a better way. The advantages of the Kimmel Center are a very professional staff all across the board, really the best stagehands, the best box office, all of those things that go into running an opera company. I have a very small staff, and it allowed us to take advantage of the very best stage because it's a new facility. It had top-of-the-line equipment, and it really opened up new doors for us. The facility we had been producing opera prior, I mean, we would walk in and we would find out that a third of the equipment wasn't working the way it said on the spec sheets. We don't have that problem. Our biggest challenge, and it's really not a unique challenge, is financial. Opera is the most expensive medium to produce, but so far we're making it, and we're looking forward to many more years and really succeeding in our mission.
You're taking a major step forward with this reworking of Dorian Gray. How did you convince the composer that this was something that your company would be capable of taking on?
We're thrilled to be presenting the picture Dorian Gray. It's the chamber version. However, we really feel like it is a brand new full production. And I say that because the history of the opera is quite interesting. Lowell Lieberman, the composer, who's very well known, he wrote this opera 10 years ago. And it was a co-commission by a company in Europe and a company in the United States, Florentine Opera. And it was performed in both, and it's sat on a shelf since. The largest obstacle to its production being the requirement of a 94-piece orchestra. And as many people know, most opera facilities can't fit that many people in a pit. I mean, the Metropolitan Opera might be able to. It would even be somewhat tight in an Academy of Music. And so when you had the costs of a large orchestra coupled with sheer space, it really became an impediment to its production. We commissioned basically a brand new version of this opera, which we hope will have better legs, so to speak, for Lowell. It's a phenomenal piece. It's very lyric. It has very exciting music. Of course, it's a classic Oscar Wilde story. Mm-hmm. What was interesting is when I first got a copy of the full score before I went to discuss this and literally convinced Lowell that it was in his best interest to do this, the largest orchestral writing was in the interludes. The structure of this piece is very much like a Britten opera. There are two acts. The first act has 5 scenes, the second act has 7 scenes, and between each scene is an interlude. So what you got was this huge, lush 94-piece orchestra playing these 30-second to 1.5-minute interludes, and then really brilliant orchestral writing, quite reduced in a sense, during any time there were singers on the stage so that they ultimately wouldn't be covered. So what we were really asking him to do with of greatest significance was changing these interludes to a more manageable orchestra. And I think he realized in his own life and maturation that there are plenty of successful operas that don't have an orchestra that require the same of, say, you know, a Strauss, Elektra, or Zalame.
Center City Opera Theater producing artistic director Andrew Kurtz. Performances of the company's production of Lowell Lieberman's The Picture of Dorian Gray are this evening, tomorrow afternoon, and on Tuesday evening at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater. The lush green foliage of the Brandywine Valley, dipping and rolling from southeastern Pennsylvania into northern Delaware, has attracted settlers for generations, among them the DuPont family, whose members have shaped much of the region's character, with family holdings turned over to the community during the 20th century. The grounds of the Wilmington Country Club, the Methodist Country Home Retirement Community, and Brandywine Creek State Park were all once owned by Henry Francis DuPont. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits Winterthur Museum and Country Estate, the home that this idiosyncratic collector of American decorative art designed and lived in as a museum in waiting.
Winterthur, the mammoth mansion filled with objects made or used in America between 1640 and 1860, started out simply as a 12-room family home. It was built in 1837 for Jacques-Antoine Bitterman and his wife, Evelina DuPont. They named it Winterthur after Bitterman's ancestral home in northern Switzerland. Before that, the property was a sheep farm owned by Evelina's father, E.I. DuPont, founder of the company that would make DuPont a household word. But even as a sheep farm, it had its celebrities, like sheep Don Pedro. Winterthur estate historian Maggie Litz says Don Pedro was in fact considered the father of the American Merino sheep.
Don Pedro was famous enough that when he died, Thomas Jefferson, who was then president, sent a letter of condolence.
Winterthur's agricultural focus continued when it became the home of Henry Algernon DuPont in 1875. He added a floor and a rectangular wing to the house, expanded the garden, and created a dairy herd, among other things. But it was under the stewardship of his son, Henry Francis, or H.F. DuPont, that Winterthur dramatically transformed from a family home to a historical showcase of unusual proportions. Over time, he would take what was a 40-room house and add on, and on, and on, as historian Maggie Litz describes.
H.F. DuPont made the house J-shaped. Today, there's 175 period rooms. That J-shape that was added, there were kitchens in there, there were bathrooms, there were hallways. We count all of those today as our rooms because they're all public spaces.
But it didn't grow all at once. In 1916, H.F. became the manager of Winterthur Farms, which encompassed farmland, a dairy herd of Holsteins, and gardens which he wanted to blend in with the surrounding landscape. Then, in the early 1920s, he took up collecting. One of the first things displayed to visitors taking a house tour is a pine dresser set out with pink patterned china. Linda Eaton says it was this piece, seen by DuPont during a visit to friends in Vermont, that started it all.
And he thought it was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen. And that got him started collecting American antiques, and Winterthur is the result.
As a collector, H.F. DuPont was voracious, says Litz. He bought not only objects like furniture, textiles, silver, brass, and pewter, he collected architecture. Maggie Litz says he sometimes even bought whole rooms. Whole rooms?
It's usually the architectural pieces. So it's the cornice around the ceiling, the mantle, the door, the window frames. The only time he could really install the entire room was when he was buying the whole house.
Incorporating whole houses into your design could conceivably present some decorating challenges. But while an ordinary collector might think about how something would fit into the house, DuPont sometimes redid the house to fit what he had collected. In 1948, DuPont turned his indoor badminton court into a courtyard and found a great way to use the exterior facades from buildings he'd purchased.
It's inside, but it feels like outside. There's cobblestones on the ground, and there are four different facades from different areas of the country and different periods. And what's most astonishing, I think, is one of them, the Red Lion Tavern from Delaware. You can walk inside, and in fact, the entire building is here.
Fabric was a decorating essential and something H.F. ravenously collected, says curator of textiles Linda Eaton. He was particular about colors.
He was coordinating the colors of the fabrics with the flower arrangements in the rooms.
And he used the colors in the room to bring the outside in.
He had seasonal changes in the period rooms to connect the colors in the house to the colors in his garden outside.
Outside, 60 of the now nearly 1,000 acres are intensively landscaped. Some formal gardens exist, but there are many areas deliberately planned to enhance the natural beauty of the landscape, says Winterthur's director of garden and estate, Chris Strand.
He romanticized the landscape here, and he loved the rural architecture, the barns and everything that we had, and he loved those views out over the meadows, seeing farm fields, and even the way the roads are designed. I mean, they're very artfully done, and it was part of the whole experience here.
Today, the staff continues to maintain this naturalistic feel and has made minimal changes, except to limit invasive plants and accommodate visitors to the estate. The Enchanted Garden, created at the site of the old swing set, is an example.
One of the things we have with a place that's this old is we have lots of things that have gotten discarded. And so they began to assemble this garden out of pieces of the estate. And the story that they used to sort of bind it all together was to say that the fairies who inhabited this garden built this garden so that they could bring the children back that used to play here.
Today's visitors can see the period rooms of the house through guided tours, browse through a library, take tram rides through the gardens, or wander through the newer wing of galleries opened in 1992 to show objects that literally don't fit in the house. The galleries also house special exhibitions. Linda Eaton curated Quilts in a Material World, an exhibition of 50 of the 300 quilts in Winterthur's collection, ranging from the 17th to early 19th century. The quilts are arranged by themes that appear in the letters of one young quiltmaker and demonstrate how, through quilting, women expressed themselves in history.
Because many quilts were made for marriage, or they're made for children, or they show the changes in women's education, or they're the story of the development of the American textile industry. Another section is politics. American women made quilts with political iconography that shows clearly that women were taking part in political discussions before they had the vote.
Although there are many kinds of quilts at Winterthur, a patchwork quilt is perhaps an apt metaphor for Henry Francis Dupont's collection and the way it evolved piece by piece. Beautiful objects in themselves, yet connected to one another, to the environment, and to the human lives they touched. Maggie Litz says Dupont left a magnificent story.
This is his autobiography. It's not written, it's built.
A historic garden, art galleries, meticulously planned gardens celebrating the natural landscape. Perhaps most of all, Winterthur is a view of the world seen through the eyes of one intellectually curious man who had the resources to indulge his creativity in an extraordinary way and then turn it over to us.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Winterthur Museum and Country Estate is open year-round, Tuesday through Sunday. Quilts for a Material World runs through September 16th. And that's our program. Our thanks this week to Hilary Holland and Sean Kelly. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.